Accession number 22675, Reel 2.
Does Crowden Reel 2.
We were told our destination was Diego Suarez, which is in the northern tip of Madagascar, a very attractive town. We weren't landing on the town side, we were on the other side. And it's very hot there because it's only 3 degrees off the equator. So we went in early on the morning and about 4:30. It was still dark. And as we were climbing into the landing craft, my friend, the Merchant Navy man from the kitchen, rushed up to me with a sack of goodies, which I told him I had no hope of carrying because we were heavily laden, not only with ammunition, but equipment we needed for 3 days, spare pair of socks, spare underwear, a balaclava, and all kinds of things that we had to carry. We had 2 pouches carrying our ammunition, 4 grenades each, a water bottle, a fighting knife, which I still have, worn on the right hip. And in fact, some of our chaps had to use it, not in that operation, but a later operation. And we landed successfully, and I remember rushing up the beach, hitting the deck like everybody else, clutching the sand and saying to myself, I've done it, I've done it. I was really excited. We got up and moved forward. At that moment, there were lots of flashes in the distance. We all hit the deck. Nothing happened. Nothing flew over our head. And so we continued our forced march to our side of the harbour. And when we got about 2 miles along the road, we found out what the flashes were. They were bird scarers for the peanut fields, because lots of peanuts are grown in Madagascar. Three troop, which landed on our left, almost immediately struck a French fort, which was fully laden with Vichy French troops, including Senegalese troops, which had been warned about. And the threat was they carried nasty-looking knives. But we never saw any of those. We got to the harbour, we made a forced march, and we had an escort of a Fleet Air Arm plane for the whole of journey. No doubt one was relieved. They carried three men. They were the old string bag type of planes, and several of those were shot down when they attacked some French 75 guns, anti-aircraft guns. We reached our destination, and to everybody's disappointment, there were no boats to take us across the harbour. And we had to wait till the next day. And soon after that, our commanding officer was sent back to his unit. He was a man named Sanguinetti, of presumably Italian descent. And we think it was the mess up over the lack of boats to get us across the harbour. By then the Navy were moving in, and at one point a French cruiser beached close to us, and all the French sailors came ashore. There were hundreds of them, but we couldn't do anything about them. We had to leave that to somebody else, because our job was to get across the harbour. But the Royal Navy sprung into action and took Royal Marines. That was before Royal Marine Commandos were formed. They were formed in late 1942, got a number of Royal Marines on board a destroyer, and the destroyer did our job and went into the harbour on the town side and landed. It was quite a sticky landing and several were killed, but they got up there. We crossed the next morning, didn't stay in the town, went outside, past the British cemetery on the way out, because 100 servicemen were killed on that first day, no commandos. But in the fort, which I described a little earlier, one of our officers, a man named Major Heron, who was eventually major and second in command, he then was a troop leader in the rank of captain, he called on the French to surrender. And they all came out with their hands up, including an officer whose hands were up, but he was clutching a grenade in one hand with a pin out, and he threw it at this particular officer, who was badly wounded. It was a foolish thing to do because all the commandos opened up and nearly every one of the French were killed. This man was shipped off to Durban to a hospital, but fortunately later rejoined us when we pulled out. Now, there were 2 man Jap submarines in the harbour, and we'd moved out to this camp about 3 miles out. And whilst we were there, one of our battleships, was at anchor in the harbour, one of the very well-known battleships whose name I've just forgotten, and a two-man sub fired a torpedo at it, hit it, sunk a merchant ship, which went in to further protect the battleship. That was sunk, but the bow was still sticking out of the water. This battleship then went slowly to South Africa, where it was repaired. I may remember the name later on. At that time, our intelligence learnt that there were two German agents living in the town of Diego Suarez, and they escaped south because we'd only occupied a small part of Madagascar. Wonderful place, flora and fauna was marvellous, strange animals, parakeets that used to fly around in bunches of 50, and there were all kinds of snakes there, chameleons, which were encouraged to change colour, and one or two of the dangerous insects, the ones that stung you, which could be fatal. But when we heard about these two German agents, they were political agents, not spies, a small convoy was formed, which was led by my troop officer, Colonel Robin Stewart, who later became our commanding officer when, at a later landing in Burma, our commanding officer was badly wounded, and he took over. And we formed a small convoy, which included something I only saw once, never again, was a very big wireless fan, and several 1,500 weight vehicles, and there were about 12 of us on it. And I had a very important job, because my 1,500 weight was full of tins of diesel for the vehicles, and my job was to lay flat out on the back of these to make sure they didn't bounce overboard, because there were no proper roads, just tracks. So we went after these two Germans. We stopped en route. There were plenty of cattle, so, and one of our chaps was a butcher, so we had some very good meals. We stopped by a stream on one occasion. I went in for a swim and was stung by a water snake, which really hurt. And when the short time we had off, we adjourned to the wireless van and could hear Vera Ling singing her song from London. I always found her voice sad. It was a sad voice. And, of course, reminded me of home, of my wife and family. My mother had died suddenly just before we left, so I wasn't able to attend her burial because, as I mentioned earlier, my eldest sister advised me to stay with the lads, which I did. Excuse me. So we eventually caught up with these Germans, but we couldn't use vehicles anymore, and eventually four people borrowed bikes from a village and pursued them on bikes. I wasn't one of them, and caught these Germans asleep at 4:30 in the morning, arrested them, brought them back to the main body where they were tied up, and they sat in the back of one of the vehicles, and we went back and handed them over to headquarters. In charge of the whole Madagascar operation was a general, a Royal Marine general, once again, I've forgotten his name temporarily. He was very tall, had a very tall walking stick, very prominent, but a very good general. So we got back to Diego Suarez. When we moved into the town, and I was on guard one morning when another Jap submarine let fly at one of our ships. It was such a loud explosion that it shook the floor I was lying on. That's how violent it was. One of our troops went out and, in fact, waited for this Jap submarine to berth on one of the extremities of the harbour. And the Japs didn't want to surrender, so they died, and we then had our own Japanese submarine. Of course, it was soon taken from us. A few days later...
How did you capture it?
When it came into land. The Japs got out, and one of our troops was waiting for it. A troop was about 60 men when it was up to strength, so there was plenty of them. And the weapons were the old World War I rifles, Tommy guns, plenty of grenades, and, of course, we were always supported by artillery, the Navy, and the Air Force. So a few days later, we boarded an Indian merchant ship, and there were no landing craft on it, and we went down the west coast of Madagascar, only about a quarter of the way, to a place called Majunga. Because wherever we landed, we then let the infantry in and they went on. Now, when we were stationed just out of Dagasarais, some African troops arrived. The white ones, they looked absolutely brilliant. All very tall men. All looked like guardsmen. They weren't guardsmen, they were just ordinary South Africans. But also, they were followed in by a black battalion, and every black, instead of wearing his army boots, had them straddled around their neck, because they weren't used to boots. They could march just as well with bare feet. So we went down to Majunga. There were no landing craft on this ship, but we had to go down a scrambling net, and the landing craft appeared from nowhere. What had happened was that the Winchester Castle was wanted for another job, presumably to bring more troops out to the east, and they let go of the landing craft, and they were came down the coast to meet us. We got on the landing craft from the scrambling nets, went inshore, had a little bit of opposition, not very much. A colleague of mine, he had his rifle shot out of his hand. It came from a civilian in a private house, and of course he was killed. One of the chaps who went in there came out with three silk shirts, which he pinched. It was one of his souvenirs. And the person who was shot in the hand was taken to a hospital. Our troops hadn't reached there then. He was put in a bed, and the Malgash nurse, that was the name for the natives of Madagascar. There was plenty of Malgash there. And even in those days, the Malgash women were topless. Unfortunately, not the French ladies who were there in droves. And he's put in this bed and treated very harshly. But when we arrived, the treatment got better. And this nurse even bought him some champagne, French champagne.
What kind of harsh treatment?
Well, wouldn't do anything for him, wouldn't get him a drink of water, and was quite rude to him because we were the enemy after all. So we only stayed there for a day, my particular troop, and we were then ferried back to our ship, up this climbing net again, which was so hard because we were all pretty exhausted. But we were pulled on board by the Indian crew, which was nice. We then went back to Dagasarais, stayed there just one day, and then went down the other coast, the east coast, to a very beautiful town called Tamatave, spelled Tamatave. When we got down there, this massive naval convoy were escorting us, and before we got round to the town, there was a nice harbour there. French guns started opening up at the convoy. A petty officer and a sailor were sent in a motorboat with a white flag to call on to surrender. They fired at the motorboat, which turned rapidly round to come back to the naval craft. And at that moment, and I can't understand how it was done, but simultaneously every gun on every battleship opened up at once. And you could see these gun emplacements going up in the air. We were on a destroyer, my particular troop. We'd been on there since our trip from Madagascar. And of course this destroyer opened up, and we were standing on deck. It was quite deafening. But suddenly the destroyer turned round, and we were then told that we were going to land in the harbour. And he went straight into the harbour, along a mole, where we jumped off, and our troop leader leading, we ran right through the town. There wasn't a soul in sight. They were all taking cover. We went round to the railway station, hid in the bushes, because we were told that a express train was coming in from the capital, which the French still held, and we were to ambush and hold the train. So we waited, and that was the terminus there. It didn't go right up to the north. It stopped at Tamatave. So we hid in the bushes, waited till the passengers got off, and then nipped in smartly to get the driver and the fireman before they damaged the train in any way. We wanted to use it to go into the capital, but once again we were told, no, sorry, that would be done by somebody else. So we had to surrender the train to the infantry, and then stayed in Tamatave, or on the outskirts of Tamatave. On one occasion, we helped to unload a merchant ship with supplies for all the British troops, and we all acquired a nice blue and white striped pair of pyjamas, which we hadn't got, of course. And then I went out with a troop, I was still only a private, but went out with about half a dozen chaps to the villages to raise some eggs so we could have a decent meal. In fact, we got over 100 eggs. On the way, I found an Englishman hiding in a bush. And for some reason, I don't know why, I wasn't even an NCO there, I didn't question him or arrest him, which I should have done. But he might have been one of our people, because prior to every landing, there was a light shone from the shore to indicate that it was all right to land. And I think he might have been one of them, or he might have been wanted, somebody wanted in the UK. However, we hurried back to our billet. On the way, we found what I thought was a barrack room of the French army, and we went through there and got one or two souvenirs and some money, which turned out to be a silly thing to do because it was part of an agricultural college and I was put on a charge, but I managed to get away with it. I then arrived with all these eggs, and we then told we were moving back to the docks. So with these 100 eggs, which will be distributed amongst us all, we marched to the docks and had six egg omelettes on the side of the docks before we were allowed to board. And we were then told we were going home. So the round trip only took 9 months, which was marvellous. And obviously they had another job in mind for us. So we went back, and we'd, on the way, we went to Cape Town instead of Durban to replenish the stores, etc. And there, Major Heron rejoined us. He thumbed a lift from Durban to Cape Town and rejoined us. And he was a marvellous officer. Everybody liked him, whatever troop they were in. He was one of their favourites. He got the MC at Dunkirk, and he eventually became second in command. So we sailed home again, this time through the Mediterranean, which really wasn't safe. But we sailed through there. And on the way, we suddenly surrounded by battleships, and it was the North African landings, which we witnessed. And an American destroyer was sent out to take a closer look at us. And we sailed back through, called it Gibraltar en route, and around the Bay of Biscay. And we came out of Greenock, but we landed in Liverpool. We then moved down to London and were billeted in the basement of the Grand Central Hotel, which I thought was an odd place to put us in London as the bombing had warmed up. My father had been taken ill, and I had a brother-in-law as a bank manager, and he had the cheek to go to the War Office to say, can I contact him because his father's dying? And they said no, but we can tell you he will soon be in the UK. Excuse me. When we got to this hotel, the RSM came to see me one morning, and he said, Crowden, I've got a rather sad message for you. RSMs knew everyone's name in the commando. When it was up to strength, it was about 450 men. It was their job to know everybody's name for some reason. And he told me my father was seriously ill, and if I came to see him at the orderly room in about half an hour, he would have a pass for me and a rail warrant, and he wanted my address, which he put in his back pocket. And I went to see him, and he gave me the pass and the warrant and said, we will notify you where to join us, and you join us, you know, when you are ready. And so I went to Waterloo, where strident marches we've been played over the loudspeakers. I found it quite interesting because all the underground stations were littered with people sheltering from the bombing, where they slept overnight and caught the train to Hampton Court and then walked home from there. Unfortunately, it was too late. My father had died, but I took the opportunity of getting a few days leave and sent for my wife, who was back in Falmouth, and she came up and joined me. Now, when I got in touch with the commander, I was told that they were temporarily in Boscombe near Bournemouth, and I was to join them there, go to the orderly room, and they could tell me where my billet was. So I did that. My wife stayed in Surrey for some time, but eventually went home because the bombing got very difficult. Now remember, the RSM had put my address in his back pocket, not my name. And during the stay in Boscombe, and incidentally, I was taken to a small hotel where there were eight of my colleagues billeted, and that was marvellous, particularly as the landlady had a daughter and suffered enormous embarrassments when serving their meals in the evening. And unfortunately, the RSM's wife joined him. They had a house to themselves and three small children. And she came across my address in his back pocket. So she wrote to that address, accusing my wife of having an affair with her husband, the RSM. My wife sent it to me, and she couldn't understand it, sent it with a covering letter. I called a committee meeting of the commandos in this small hotel and read it to them, and eventually we came to the conclusion that it was the address I'd given to the RSM when he wanted to know my home address to send me home. And so I wrote and explained to my wife, and then I said, well, what shall I do? Well, there's only one thing to do, go and see the RSM's wife, which I did. And on the way round, coming towards me was the RSM on the other side of the road. He walked past his house, which was close to the orderly room, which was another private house. And I did a smite arse left and said, good morning, sir. Good morning, Crowden. And I thought, God, if only you knew where I was going. I rang the doorbell. The wife came to the door. And I said, good morning, madam. I'm Private Crowden. My wife has received a letter from you. And I wanted to explain why your husband, the RSM, had my address. And I explained, and she didn't believe me, because apparently he had a bit of a record as far as women concerned. Anyway, I said, look, I've just seen your husband, the RSM. Can I come in? Because I'd like to speak to you further about it. She said, all right then. She was wearing a pinny. She was ironing at the time, carried on doing the ironing, three noisy children on the settee, and I went through it once more. Don't think she believed me, but she settled for it. In the evening, of course, all the chaps wanted to know what had happened. And I told them, and of course it eventually went round the commando, but I don't think the RSM ever heard about it. About that time, one of my very best friends, one evening, said he'd been called out on guard. Now, when we'd been in Dartmouth previously, before going out to Madagascar, he'd fallen in love with the fishmonger's daughter. We were stationed in a fishmonger, a fried fishmonger. Our bedroom smelt of fish and chips all the time. When we got back, she'd lost interest in him, had lost another boyfriend who was a merchant navy. His ship was sunk in the Atlantic. And me and my colleague used to go out every night to a pub opposite, drink cider, come back and have fish and chips every damned evening. But this girl had fallen out of love with him. He found out, and one evening he said, I've been called out on guard, the one short. Went out in denims, which wasn't right, and plimsolls on his feet, which wasn't right. He should have been properly dressed, but nobody twigged it. Took his rifle with him, went into a local park, put the rifle, end of the rifle barrel in his mouth, and shot himself, committed suicide. So that was very sad, because he was a lovely chap named Govan, his name. And apparently, for a time, he was rejected by his parents for committing suicide. No doubt they were quite religious. It was then decided to move us to the Isle of Wight. I liked being in Boscombe, plenty of nice shops. They had Turkish bars there where you could get the dust of Madagascar out of your skin pores. But we had to go to the Isle of Wight. We didn't go over the ferry, the normal fashion. We went down to the docks where landing craft were waiting for us. And we landed on the Needles, of all places. And as we were landing, RAF fighters were screaming overhead, and it was treated as a landing. And we landed and then dispersed to various towns in the Isle of Wight. Can I have a break? When we landed on the Needles, we were taken to various towns. My troop, which was still five troop, although I was to go to two others eventually in headquarters, we went to Shanklin, lovely little town. I was able to invite my wife over. She had to get a pass to come onto the Isle of Wight. And when she arrived, I wasn't there to meet her at Ryde because I was out in a scheme of some kind. and but she was met by the Red Caps and had everybody, of course, civilians as well as troops, carried an identity pass, and she was able to tell them who she was, and she eventually joined me in Shanklin, and we had a lovely billet with a Mr. and Mrs. Barrow. In fact, Mrs. Barrow really taught my wife to cook. He was working on aircraft work. They eventually moved to Australia, and to this day, she's still alive. I'm 81. She must be nearly 90, but she still keeps in touch. We were very happy there. Training started in earnest. By now I'd done 3 commando landings in Madagascar, but before the end of the war, I would have done 7 commando landings. I was only injured once by our own grenade. It didn't stop me going into action. And so I was one of the very lucky ones, because during the course of the war, many of our chaps were killed or wounded. Excuse me. So we're on the Isle of Wight, where we spent quite a long time again. We did go over to Portsmouth on one occasion when I bumped into a friend who was the son of the owner of our local laundry. And the reason was he in Portsmouth, he was playing football at Fratton Park. His name was Lindsay, and he was in the services, formerly the goalkeeper of Kingston, now playing for England, all servicemen, and was in goal that day to play for England, and invited me to watch it. Of course, I couldn't, and I was in the army. And on another occasion, they took us to the New Forest, and believe it or not, it's for jungle training. It's quite unlike the jungle, but there were a few trees there. And we did all kinds of things. My wife and I used to have a swim where possible in the evening, and we used to go on one of the beaches, one of the remote beaches near Shanklin, but we always had to climb through the barbed wire to get into the sea. And on one occasion we were standing in the water admiring the view when 3 German planes came over, and we learnt about a day later that they were a new model of German plane. Then the artillery were not only based in Portsmouth, but of course on the Isle of Wight, and they used to fire in a box, and we were kind of transfixed to where we were, looking up and not moving, and all these guns opened up, and they actually knocked down 2 Germans, 2 German planes of the 3. The other one turned tail and presumably got home. So that was quite interesting. Well, I don't think my wife was all that keen on it. I took my first stripe, my Lance Corporal stripe, taken by the RSM, the cadre, and one of the things we had to do, there were about 8 of us, 4 stood one side of a football field and 4 the other, and we gave simultaneous orders, so a hell of a ding going on, and that was the part of the course we did, and so I ended up as a Lance Corporal. And unfortunately, when you were promoted, you were moved to another troop, and I moved to the heavy troop. The heavy troop had heavy machine guns and 3-inch mortars, which took some carrying. But being an NCO, I didn't have to carry them, unfortunately. But I didn't stay long with them. I promoted again to corporal and then to Lance Sergeant. So I then went from 6th Troop to 4th Troop, and I was a Lance Sergeant until the war ended, when I was lucky enough to get 1, 2, 3 further promotions, and ended up in the shoes of the RSM. I was, in fact, I understand, according to an English national, the youngest RSM of the British Army, but in no way could I or anyone else compete with the Guards RSMs. And although I was the youngest RSM at that time, I read some years later that a Guardsman promoted to RSM was, in fact, younger than me. He would have been a real RSM. I was just an amateur, really, but nevertheless, I had to do the duties. So there we were in the Isle of Wight, and one notorious thing that happened. Our troop that was in Ventnor, 2 Troop, one day were on the beach training with demolitions. They had plastic explosives, they had gun cotton, which was slightly smaller than the house brick, which was used for demolitions. And when they finished their training that day, they had a piece of gun cotton over. Now, a habit we learned in Madagascar was if you threw a grenade in the sea, you'd have plenty of fish for tea. And they got used to that. So they had this piece of gun cotton over and a primer and a fuse, set it up, lit it, threw it into the sea, and there was an enormous explosion, and it broke most of the windows along the seafront in Ventnor. All our chaps dived for cover, used their loaf, got up, and pointed to the sky. And when all the locals were running out in a panic, they were saying, "There it goes," and pointing to what should have been a German plane. There was no sign of a German plane. They didn't get away with it. They got away with it for about 48 hours, but their troop headquarters was in a building next to the police station.